Hello, and welcome to CRO Insights, How CROs Win, the podcast that uncovers the key markers of successful revenue leadership, brought to you by the CRO Collective in partnership with the Revenue Operations Alliance. In each episode, we'll explore the CRO career path, the major challenges facing CROs today, and discover strategies for building aligned revenue engines that scale your company's growth. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, good. So I'm in the Northeast in the United States, and Michael's coming in from Brisbane, and it's 11 o'clock where you are. Is that right?
11 p.m. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's 9 a.m. here, so it's an interesting way that we kind of crunch time in today's world. So, Michael, thank you. I know that you and I had a little bit of a brief introductory conversation, so I'd rather have you introduce yourself, you know, a little bit more depth in the background and, you know, why it is you're here and, you know, what role you play right now and sort of what you're up to and a little bit more about the company that you manage.
Yeah, sure. So Michael Reed, the CEO of Megaport. So my background, I suppose, prior to Megaport, I was the CRO at Thousand Eyes, which was a SaaS-based company acquired by Cisco. And prior to that, I ran a whole bunch of other different acquisitions throughout my time living in the Bay Area near San Francisco for about 5 years. Prior to that, I ran Northern Region of Australia for Cisco, and prior to that, I ran banking and finance and sales. So I've sort of came up through the ranks in a sales capacity and had an opportunity to run a number of global businesses from a sales perspective or CRO function, and then was the CRO at Thousand Eyes, which was a lot of fun. Stepped into that company when there was about 150 people in the CRO function. We grew that to 400. Had a chance to scale that business, which was incredibly, an amazing journey, certainly at the time from a growth perspective. And then that gave me an opportunity to step into the CEO role of Megaport. So Megaport is a network as a service platform. So we're a recurring revenue business with the majority of our revenue based out of the United States, but founded in little old Brisbane, Australia. So we are a sort of a fascinating story for a company that's publicly traded on the Australian Stock Exchange, but actually left the shores of Australia and actually sort of took the world by storm. And the majority of that growth came out of the United States. And so we look and smell very much like a $200 million ARR business based in sort of the Valley that scaled through the US and then globally. It's just that we started here in Brisbane, the Valley, Fortitude Valley, another Valley, and grew the other way. So, yeah, quite a unique business to be on the Australian Stock Exchange and be sort of so strong globally. But that's been a lot of the fun of taking over this role, actually. So, yeah, that's a quick background.
Well, that's great. That's really helpful. So it gives me a couple of good things I wanted to talk to you about, because you've had the benefit of being both the chief revenue officer at a rather large company, and now you're the CEO of another one. So your perspective would be really interesting, because you sort of know now what it's like to have had the role. And now also now that you're leading a company, I guess the question is, do you have a CRO now? Do you manage one? Have you hired one? And do you work with one now in your company?
We actually have the CRO function slightly split into a couple of different roles. So if you look at it, I have a head of North American or strategic alliances globally, and then all of the customer, all of the partner and channel business, including our data center operators, in another function. And then I have the supporting functions that wrap around them. So it's slightly different, like a deconstructed CRO model, if that makes sense, inside Megaport. But we are a bit smaller. So we're only 275 people actually delivering that, $200 million of ARR. So it's a really interesting business, highly automated and distributed in an interesting way. So I can talk more about that.
Yeah, you could. I mean, I think it's interesting because this is a big part of the conversation we have, is how the CRO function or role is different based on the business model, the revenue model, the commercial model, the delivery model, right? So in the world of the chief revenue officer, the CRO collective is at a high level, maybe talk about we agree on this. The CRO is someone, ultimately, an authority, a revenue leader who is responsible for all revenue-related functions of the company. They report into the CEO, and their job is to orchestrate all the functions that lead to revenue. And that includes sales, that includes marketing, that includes customer growth and retention, et cetera, et cetera. And I understand that when the companies get more complicated, it certainly still has, there's some neck to choke with a person who has the title, but it's a function, and it's a function that's being led by a lot of people. So in that context, I'd love to hear more about the way that you did that and about the business that you run right now.
Yeah. So I might give you my perspective and lead into it with my perspective on a CRO to CEO role as it sort of leads into it. So I think that the CRO role is a really multidisciplinary role. It's funny because I think you have different paths, but it's like every role you take is always a step up, and there's a whole range of things that you've never done. That when you step into a new role, in theory, if you're moving up, there's always components of that that you've never had the experience.
There's a newness to any new thing, correct? No doubt.
Yes. But I think one of the hardest steps is actually not the step from CRO to CEO. It's actually probably from like the head of North American sales, which is your traditional line, to then step into a CRO role. And the reason I believe that's a harder step, I'm not saying a CEO role is easy, by the way, but I think it's a harder step to go from like head of North American sales, if that's your path, to that CRO, because you traditionally come up through a line of front. Let's say you start your career, you're an inside seller, you're an SDR, you're hunting, you progress to a, maybe it's a an account manager role or a frontline sales function. You do really well there and you get promoted to a frontline manager role, and then you get to next line manager, you get sort of a regional manager, then a director role. It's all in sales and you're all managing a, you know, forecast, drive, hustle, close deals, med pick, whatever process that you're driving, activity, hunger, drive, close the quarter, start again, wipe the board, let's go. It's that sort of, it's sort of a one-dimensional
approach. It's very linear. It's very focused. It's very much based on a acquisition hunter mode, almost constantly in a perpetual day-to-day moment. You sleep that way too, I know.
Correct. Yeah. You get up, you breathe, you're hungry.
Exactly.
Now, there are different modes, so that you could be like a commercial rep where you're dealing with like a smaller customer set from in terms of size of customer. So it's a lot more of a velocity motion. Or you could have a medium set of size customers. You could have very high end enterprise. You know, you could have one account. Your entire focus is just to be strategic on that. Could do one deal in 18 months, whatever. There are varied scopes inside those roles. There's varying complexity in terms of the negotiations that you're going through. And there's an absolute art and sophistication through that. And it's such a critical function for the business. It's new revenue growth, realistic new ARR ideally. But that can come from existing customers expansion, or it can come from net new logos. Anyway, it's an art in itself, but you sort of progress up through that line. And all of a sudden you get promoted through these roles, but you end up as head of North America. And in some instances, you can literally just have the frontline sellers that are bringing net new logos and new ARR. And then all of a sudden you step to the CRO role and you have this thing called customer success that appears, which is a different animal. Yeah. And then you have this channel business, which is totally different. And you probably grew up thinking customer success is this sort of, you know, the odd duck in this thing, and they're not this, and you've got a viewpoint of that, and you think channel has never helped you with anything, and it's all about frontline sales and this, that, and the other. And then you get up there and you realize that there's these solutions architects that you're running. Channel's a different view. You have this thing called RevOps. What on earth is that? Now, all of a sudden, you're responsible for the rigor, the automation, the tools, the systems, the stuff that you probably hated doing when you were in that frontline sales function.
Yep.
But now, all of a sudden, you find yourself making decisions around the automation of the business, how the company will flow from a med pick style. Is that what you're going to choose? And then how does that drive back into how you monitor it with Salesforce, or is it Clary? Or this is a new world. So I think that leap is much harder. You're also running finance. You're really responsible for HR. The legal negotiations come into play. You have an absolute responsibility to drive the revenue overall. So all of a sudden you care about the recurring nature of it versus just the win. And all of a sudden customer success, you realize the true value of customer success. And actually more of the business is responsible by the customer success team than these frontline sellers that when you were in that space, you thought it was all about that. So I think that that's the hardest step in these businesses, because you've got to step into that role and truly understand the value that each of those functions brings. And you have to become very much a not necessarily an expert. You have to be deeply understanding of the value of each one of those. You have to understand how each one runs. And then you have to put systems and structures and processes and a belief around them. Then you need to allocate OPEX in a way that makes sense as well. And you can't starve one of those functions in favor of another, because you could end up causing pain for the business. So it's this delicate balance, like an organism or an ecosystem that you never really had to think about before that. So that's, I think, the hardest step. Because if you think about if you're a really good CRO, you end up respecting all of those functions and spending the time to find the incredibly talented humans for those functions. And what I mean by that is, you don't have to be a rock star channel person to be a CRO, but you need to respect and understand the value that channel brings for that particular company, whatever that may be, and find the person that gets out of bed, that punches the air and is excited about building that. And so it becomes this game of understanding the value of it and then finding the talent to drive that, and then having a strategy that will align to those pieces. And once you spend that time and energy in that, you start to get your customer success right, the value of your RevOps leader, the importance of having the training and component, all these sort of things start lining up. You eventually get to a point where you're like, the success of the company starts aligning there. You realize that the next piece of your puzzle is product. And so whilst you don't own product, you have this constant feedback from the customer base of what the product should be, why it's not good enough, why you're not competing, what should be there, pricing, et cetera, et cetera. So you end up, if you're running a strong business, you end up so tightly aligned back into the product organization. And now what you start to do is you partner really tightly with your CPO, chief product officer, and then usually the engineering team to keep innovating and building the products that your customers need, get the pricing right so that you can be successful and you can continue to grow the business. These sorts of pieces of the puzzle, to step from that into a CEO role is actually not too difficult. And what I mean by that is, the only thing you're adding to the control is, well, there's a few, but the biggest change is in being a CEO is you now have responsibility for product. Mm-hmm. And i.e. product and engineering also roles to you. But if you've spent enough time being passionate about that in partnership with them, you're actually, it's not too much of a leap outside of what you do. HR and legal are already there in a CRO function. If you own marketing in the CRO function, it's already there as well. If you didn't own marketing, you would have been very, very tightly aligned with marketing in that CRO. So again, it's not a huge leap to step into that. I think the only other pieces of the puzzle are an acknowledgement. In my case, I'm a public CEO, so you end up with a lot of time with the reporting from an external obligation to our shareholders, our investors, our analysts, et cetera, earnings calls, and you have to start to learn the obligations that you have from a regulatory standpoint, from a governance perspective. But I would say that is all easy to learn, as long as if you've got that skill set, and you can also surround yourself with talented folks who live and breathe that space to ensure that you deliver what's required there. So I'd actually say the step between North American sales leader to CRO is the hardest, CRO to CEO, so long as it's a company that is in a scale phase. I say all of that, noting that in my experience moving to Megaport, it makes sense. And where that is a company that's already found product market fit and it's got mm-hmm. a product set that's growing. I'm not the right person to come up with a product idea and start it from zero. I'm not the product founder I'm not coding products. And that's where I think there's a difference between CEO founders of VC-backed companies that literally had the idea of the product, built it, scaled it, and grew it and became that CEO. I think there's the opportunity for a CRO to CEO is after they've found product market fit and they're looking to scale and grow. Yeah.
It all makes sense. It's great. You're speaking my language here. It's great. And I agree with everything you said. down to the letter. And I want to talk to you about a couple of things, because you're speaking to an issue that is pervasive in today's marketplace, which is the fact that you move basically what you said is from what I would call a functional mindset to a systems mindset. So if I'm running a sales organization, I have a functional remit. I wake up in the morning with a spear in my hand. I know exactly what that spear is supposed to do and all the things related to what that spear's intention is. And that's pretty much my world. And you know, no one can pull the spear out of my hand. It's like I keep it in my hand all the time. Because that's how I'm incentivized. I mean, that's my job. And so, and as long as I'm carrying that in my hand, everyone knows what I represent and what I'm supposed to do. And my context is really clear and everyone understands it. And that's how everyone works around me. And then all of a sudden you're a CRO and they take the spear out of your hand. And they're like, that doesn't matter to you anymore. So just get rid of it. And you're like, whoa, hold on a second. Like I sort of, how do I define myself here? And I think that while what you said is true, the issue I have with this is that it shouldn't be that way in this respect. I think that there's a weird dynamic associated with business growth that you need functional focus like that. You have to have somebody that is that specifically designed, like a component or a part of a car. You know, you're a carburetor and that's your job and that's it. But you're part of a system. And if the company is being led in a way that you know that there is going to be a progression of leadership, it would seem to me that a lot of the issues related to the inertia that happens between those two steps could be avoided if the person who's running sales is introduced to that stuff earlier so that it's not as difficult. And I think that part of the problem is there's a weird dynamic between, well, no, we need you focused because that's how we're going to make our money. But at the same time, too, you're useful to me for the first, or it's risky to me for the first 6 months when you switch jobs because there's a chance it might not work out. And I can't afford to have that happen, but you're the best person to do it. So how do we prepare better for that? I'm thinking, like, what are your thoughts on maybe ways that the North American, let's say in your example, the North American head of sales could be better equipped so that that is not as difficult? Like, what could something a leader do with that salesperson role to prepare for that trend? That progression more so that it's an easier your issue. What would you think about that?
I think it's the acknowledgement of the breadth of the company, actually accepting that there are these different functions and they're so critical and important. And the way it's the way you achieve that is by being curious and not really sort of this one-dimensional focus. By the way, I say that leap is the hardest. The ones who you back to make that leap are the ones that are throughout their career working incredibly tightly with customer success. Mm-hmm. With, if I look at it, some of the enterprise leaders inside Thousand Eyes were very, very strong at tightly aligning with that customer success team. They worked out that that sort of pod mentality between customer success, frontline sales, and technical support is super powerful. And whilst they don't own the leadership for the solutions architect or the customer success, the reality is they are the leader of that pod, even though they're not a hardline leader. So they become the subscribe to leader versus that sort of command and control leadership. And that is where they bring the customer success person on the journey, the solutions architect on that journey, and then they steer the ship. It happens quite often with deep enterprise customers where you're sort of corralling multiple complex components.
No doubt about that. More complicated businesses require that sort of integration. But if you're in a SaaS business where it's very subscription-based, you don't have that a lot. You know, you just, there's renewals and you get new customers and it's a factory, you move it on and you walk away. And, you know, a lot of the companies I deal with are less service-based. They're more SaaS-based. And that's not by design. That's just the way it worked out. I'm finding it's actually more interesting to work with enterprise businesses. And I say enterprise not because of it's a distinction of their size. It's just a distinction of the type of business they're in. They're selling something that's a more complex offering that requires more time to buy and more people to use, right? And so you're right. And that's going to necessitate that more people are involved in the beginning process in order to make sure the product sticks. And so by nature of that business, you're going to have more people involved and you have to create a business where there's a lot more cooperation to get the thing across the board. It's no different than like if I have to move a very, very, very heavy object, I'm going to have to invite like seven people to come over and help me pick it up and carry it. And so we're going to have to work together. By the time we get to the destination, we've probably already figured out what each one of us is capable of because we just had to work together to do it. Whereas if I can pick it up myself, I sort of bring it over to the next guy. I have no idea what he's good at, but it doesn't matter because I got it to him and I'm going to walk away and go pick up the next one. So I think that there is a degree to which I think that the SaaS model in a way has created silos because the nature of it is that, you know, too many few people can do so much of it and effectively that you've sort of become distant from each other. Yeah. And I think that because a lot of businesses have adopted SaaS based models for how they build their businesses, they almost bake in some of that stuff into it and they don't think about the fact that there needs to be more. It's siloed, right?
Yeah.
So this is sort of what CROs are intended to do, is that their job is to break silos down and say, okay, like you said, like, I had no idea how important this renewal business was. It actually is more important than this crap that we're doing every day. And I had no idea. That's where we make all of our money. And no one ever told me that. Well, I think that you said something interesting, which is there's one profile is someone who's just naturally curious and they sort of want to know this stuff. And it's a personality profile. They'd like to know things. So, you know, you're lucky enough to get somebody in a job that they're naturally curious. They're going to be someone whom you look at them and by their nature, they're going to want to look at the world that way. And they're probably going to be good for the job. But what if I don't have that? What if I have someone who's an amazing head of sales, but they're not really curious? What can I do as an organization to force that curiosity so that it can happen without me having to worry about, you know, accidentally finding the right person and maybe making a culture one that fosters that sort of thing?
Or sometimes forcing something on someone maybe doesn't make sense. What I mean by that is if that human is very happy being that in that role, and that's there's a lot of look, the majority of folks are frontline sellers. The best probably retire out of a frontline seller role happy, having never taken that leadership part.
Great job. They make a lot of money. They're independent. They wake up with a spear in their hand every morning. They come home with a pelt and they do it every day and they're happy. I agree. You did a perfectly good job.
Some folks are best to actually, they don't want to move beyond that. I would say that, like, in answer to your question, you're finding the folks that have a natural desire to progress their career beyond an individual contributor and have a desire to get into leadership and then go across that. And so the folks that have that desire, that are interested, are naturally open to trying to learn more and grow. And that's a much easier path to follow. And sometimes people need a little bit of guidance to get there. There's lots of folks where you're like, look, you're a rock star. I mean, it happened to me. I had someone that I'd done incredibly well from a frontline sales perspective. And eventually someone said, like, you know that you've got more to offer than this. I think you've proven that you can crush this over and over again. I think you're done proving it. It's now time to actually step into a leadership position. And it took someone to recognize that in me to sort of trigger it to start with. Someone sort of very senior that I respected to sort of state that. So in that instance, they sort of energized me to go and step beyond that. And if you'd asked me sort of a year or two before, I would have told you the greatest role in the history of time is an enterprise frontline sales leader, seller, not a leader, but and I'm never moving, you know. And so you progress. Yes.
I had that job for 20 years. I know exactly what you mean, and it is great.
An awesome job.
And what happens is you're good at it. You show a propensity for it, and naturally, what's going to happen is someone above you is going to come to you and tap you on the shoulder and say, "We need you to do more, or something different, or we need you, you know, to lead something," because you're always looking for leadership. There's a need for it.
The so one that is the ones who I find are successful in that are the folks that have gotten to a point where firstly they are successful, but they've found this moment in time where they start coaching or mentoring other younger talent, earlier in career folks, the folks that are newer, and they find themselves doing it naturally. And then there's a moment where I think you personally, it happens, I think, for a lot of folks, is where you're the success of your mentee becomes more exciting than your own success to an extent. And when that happens, it's like that's the time to progress from a leadership perspective, because all of a sudden you've proven to yourself you can do it yourself, but you're so excited when the person that you've supported to do it does it. That's a really good trait to have from a leadership standpoint, as opposed to being, I think I've run out of runway here as a frontline seller. I think I have to move into a different role and become a leader. Probably not the right path.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think it's a really cool way to codify a the DNA of a future leader. You know, there's certain milestones and observations that you make in these people whom they naturally rise into a certain level because you observe things about the way they behave that indicate that they're right for the next thing, that there's a part of their nature that's calling them to do something bigger. And they may not even be aware of it. They're just following their instincts. But you, as a seasoned leader, look at that and go, okay, see this person? This person talks to 4 people a day and helps them do better. I didn't ask them to. So this person is someone who likely is, their soul is telling them to run things and they didn't even know it. So I'm going to go and I'm going to say, look, dude, what are you doing here? You obviously want to lead things. Let's get you doing that. Okay. Whereas if you have to walk over to somebody who's, and honestly, selfish sellers are great. They make a lot of money and they do well for the company because they just want to make a lot of money. They're great to have. You know, I've had a bunch of them work for me, and you know, I know these guys are not going to give up a dollar, but they're going to make a lot of them, and you know, it's fine. You know, they're a good profile for that. But I'd never ask that person to help anybody else because they would never do it. They would see it as being time away from them going out and making more money for themselves. Like, what the hell would I want to help this person for? I could spend more time on the phone making money. Okay, great. Then you keep doing that. But yes, there are people who are more, I think they're systems thinkers. They're curious people. They have a care about other people and watching other people grow. They're stimulated by mentorship and support and coaching of other people. And they want to learn about the way that their job works by looking at the pieces that touched them. And I don't know, you know, it's an interesting thing for us to discuss some other time. You know, it's like, is there sort of like a skill set in how leaders are able to observe the people that work for them so that they can see this stuff better. I'm amazed sometimes. I don't think that a lot of leaders see these things. They don't look at it that way. Matter of fact, I've seen times where they say, what are you doing spending all this time working with all these other people? You should be selling.
Mm.
You know, you're not making money. You're out helping other people. Stop it. You know, I need you to sell more, as opposed to, oh, okay, this person's someone who wants to help people. I'd put them in that position, because we look at people very functionally. Like, we want them to do a certain thing instead of looking at their nature. Putting people in the right seat.
You compensate them towards not actually being team players to an extent. You compensate them for their individual performance, and there's no benefit for them to help someone else. So everything you're driving them towards says, don't do that.
Don't do that.
Yes.
It's crazy.
You know what I think one of the earliest signs for a SaaS-style business is the people that start to care about adoption. And the reason I think adoption's the key is, we talk about annual recurring revenue and we sell this thing called annual recurring revenue. It's what everyone is paid to do. But the thing about ARR is the first R is recurring. And without it actually recurring, it's pointless revenue. And so it's like my gym membership. It is a very high risk to be not recurring because of my adoption. I don't go enough. And so the point is the reps who sell something and then worry about it being adopted, even though they don't get paid to have it adopted, it's more of a customer success function, start to be the ones that understand the importance of that for the broader business and think more about the business. And then you can, because that, if you understand that concept, you actually understand that what you're building is ARR, a recurring revenue business model. If you don't get it adopted, it doesn't recur. If it doesn't recur, it's not healthy for the business. It doesn't grow. That's the true nature of business. So it's like a three-dimensional chess thinking. If you see that, then you actually usually see someone who is thinking about it in a different way.
Yeah, this is great. So I'm curious, if you mind, you explained this to me before, but it was fascinating. Could you explain a bit more about the current business that you run and what it does and how it works and the customers you serve and the way you deliver value to people?
Yeah. So Megaport is the largest network as a service platform on the planet. I call ourselves like an 11-year-old startup that's publicly traded. So we operate and act like a startup in that we are fast and we innovate hard. We're lean and we're very disruptive to the market that we're in. So we're disrupting the traditional telcos and carriers. We're providing a service where we live inside 850 data centers globally, and we've pre-built this massive network running on fiber between all those different locations. And we have about 3,000 physical devices like switches and routers in each of those locations, separate fiber contracts, like 2,000 or 3,000 contracts for fiber, stitching it together. We have 2,600 customers on top of that with 30,000 services in 26 countries. And we don't have a single human that touches that entire network. It is totally delivered via code and automated. So in less than 60 seconds, you can connect at incredible speed from any data center to a cloud, from any data center to another data center, or from any cloud to any cloud. And so it's this, yeah, quite fascinating platform that was invented to connect you to the clouds. And over the years, it's continued to expand from a product set. It's cool and a little bit niche in that, in the world that we live in.
Like, all is it like a cloud to cloud connecting platform? Is it basically what it is?
A really good example is, in fact, how we started was when AWS came out. And if you recall, there was a time before cloud, but there was a time where AWS was trying to
remember before there was a cloud. Yeah. There were like databases and there were data centers and there was big hard drives. And, you know, I had like a stack of hard drives on my desk that I used to fill with crap. I remember those days. Yeah,
exactly. Before the cloud. Well, yeah. During that time, I mean, Amazon, when they first came out, they were trying to convince companies that this thing called the cloud was a good idea. And then what happened is they had to get to them. So the challenge was everyone lived in a data center. That it was all in some data. It was on-prem or it was like a co-location data center. Yep. Mm-hmm. And then Amazon comes along and says, use our cloud. Well, the cloud is just another computer in someone else's data center, like, yep. You know, ultimately. And so you've got to get from your current infrastructure, which you'd have a ton of, and you needed to connect at a very high speed into AWS. And if you couldn't get that high speed connection, you couldn't migrate your data, your traffic, and move across. And so Amazon Web Services realized really early that they need a company like Megaport to allow you to connect instantly. So it was actually Amazon that pulled us from Australia to the US and actually got us to just roll out everywhere, because the value proposition for them needed someone like Megaport to quickly connect. Because what they would do is they'd turn up to someone like JP Morgan and they'd be like, hey, there's this cool thing called the cloud. We need you to get there. They'd be like, cool, I'll sign up for that. They go and talk to their traditional telco. And then 4 to 5 months later, the telco would deliver a fiber cable to them that may or may not deliver what they need. Whereas okay. With Megaport, it'd be, I've convinced you to join AWS. In 60 seconds, you can connect at high speed from your data center to your cloud now and start pumping traffic into it. So that's what dragged us there. And then what's happened is Azure became very strong. Microsoft's incredibly dominant. They caught up. They're a very fast follower. And then Google appears and they say, well, we're also a cloud provider. And then Larry at Oracle goes, you know what? Congratulations. You've had Oracle your whole life. You now have Oracle Cloud. Now, all of a sudden, you had this one cloud strategy with AWS. You've just with your contract through Microsoft, you've inherited Office 365 and then all their stuff. And then Google, because someone like, you know, whatever it is, AI something. And then you've got Oracle over there. And now what you've got are all these niche cloud providers popping up and GPU as a service. So we're seeing companies like CoreWeave who are becoming the next cloud provider with huge amounts of NVIDIA GPUs pumping out all this AI, new compute. So it's a completely different story. So it's an interesting space that we're in.
Mm. Yeah, it is fascinating. It is. And what is NVIDIA is doing right now is pretty amazing. I think I look at the network requirements to run AI are, it's like crypto, you know, it's going to be so massive to get these things going. People don't think about that. You know, these things just don't happen. You know, there needs to be something running it. So that's fascinating. So is there's no one else doing what you're doing? Are you the only player in that particular area? Are there a competitor?
We have, if you look at it, our competitors are the traditional telcos. And so that takes them, could take up to 3 months to deliver a service. So that the speed we can deliver at is instant. If it's on our network, it's instant, obviously. It's also incredibly well priced because of the way we've built it. So we're disruptive on price, disruptive on speed, disruptive on redundancy. What's weird about our space is we're a truly global player. If you want to connect anywhere on the planet, you can do that with us because we're in 26 countries. Most telcos are actually only terrestrial based. So if you look at it, AT&T, very strong in the US, but outside of the US, not anywhere. British Telecom is great in the UK. Deutsche Telekom, amazing in Germany. You know, beyond that, not that strong. Telstra in Australia, very good in Australia. Second you leave those shores. And most of it's because they owned copper cables, and then the fiber assets, and it usually came from government investments. And so they have like monopolies almost in their market. But that monopoly doesn't extend to any other location because there's already another company that that was from that thing that has a monopoly. So we are in this really unique space, very unique. It's very odd, actually. it's an odd space.
Well, it's great. It sounds exciting. And I did some interesting looking into it when we spoke last. And it's fascinating, you know, this solution and how relevant it is given what's going on in the marketplace today. So, I guess the way we'd wrap this up is if you were to identify, let's say, like the top three most vital characteristics of a great chief revenue officer, how would you describe, say someone came to you and said, Michael, I'm looking for a chief revenue officer. What are the qualities that I should be looking for in somebody? And what would indicate that someone is the right person for this job?
I think the first piece is you've got to have the hunger and drive. They're not easy roles. You really have to have this relentless drive to understand each part of the functions that you're leading and ensure that that you're winning in each space. It just takes a huge amount of time and energy. So the first thing I'd say is that you've got to be all in personally and professionally for that. I think you've got to have come from a background where you're very strong in one or two of those functions. Most folks come from the frontline sales piece. Depending upon the company, there might be a customer success leader that might be more important. It could come from a more technical background, but I think whoever it is has to be very strong from a multidisciplinary perspective. Like you have to believe that they can multi sort of task across those areas and that they can at least be understanding of what's required and inspire the right human to come there. So at the end of the day, they need to attract wicked talent. They don't have to be perfect at every function, but they need to acknowledge it and then find the right talent for that. And so they've got to inspire a good human to come across. So if you're looking at that, you'd want to see someone that has a viewpoint on maybe the people that they know for those roles or that they can hire quickly with their connections. The hiring part's the trickiest. And so if you come with previous relationships with folks you trust and believe in, that's awesome. The only other thing I'll say on that piece is quite often each company is different. So you take one CRO out of one company and put them in a CRO in a different company. And what you find is their motions are different. The buying center could be different. It could be a velocity motion versus a high-end enterprise. It's not like one size fits all. I think it's you need horses for courses. And so I think you just need to acknowledge that each role could be different. And someone who could be highly successful in one doesn't necessarily mean they'd be successful in the other. So put the energy into finding the right human for that. And I've seen that a lot in that people put the wrong CRO into that business. Mm-hmm. They were a CRO before. They think, oh, it's perfect. But actually, when you really, and you wonder what went wrong, you're like, well, this is like purely sold through managed service providers. It's a pure channel play. And this person was a frontline enterprise seller hardened through and through. And that's what they believed the right answer was. And right. So when you try to sort of, when everything, you know, when you're a hammer, everything starts looking like a nail, as you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just, I think it's just finding the right person for that. But usually you'll understand that business, you'll talk it through. Yeah.
That's an interesting one. I like that point. There is this propensity for people to think, oh, well, you know, you had the job before and you're good at it, so come in here and do the same thing. But you do have to look at the landscape that they were successful in and see if it's a fit for the landscape that they're coming to. I mean, some can adapt.
But some can, yeah. I mean, if you get the right hunger and drive and experience. The thing is, some folks, if you look at their career, they spent their whole life, you know, 23 years in one company. Yeah. And in most cases, just frontline sales all the way through. And then someone's finally promoted them to CRO and they wonder why, like, it's so hard. And it's like, well, this is A, a different company. B, you're now responsible for RevOps, that thing you hated. And, you know, like all those changes. Whereas if you've had someone with lots of different experience, that's usually helpful. But the problem is, they could have had lots of experience because each time they're pushed out of a company because they're not successful. So It's a tough
It's interesting. I what you're saying is fascinating because there's this battle always going on between this idea of, you know, loyalty and sustainability.
Yes.
You know, you look at a resume and you see somebody who's been in a company for 7 years, like, wow, this person like knows how to stick around. I like that. They show stability. You see somebody else who has a job every 2 years. And I had this interview with a company in Mountain View way back. And it was a fascinating experience. I was put through this big process with this big company out there. And I really understood how the Silicon Valley, you know, mentality works and how they hire. It was really amazing. I didn't get the job, but I learned a lot. And this one guy was taking me around. You know how they do these interviews? They walk with you. They go, let's go take a walk. And you walk around the park together. It was like a whole new thing for me. It's in New York and you sit in an office and they stare you down with like light in your face. You know, it's a whole different world than here, you know? And so anyway, we're walking around this park and he says to me, you know, in today's market and for the future market, we're a lot more interested in people who've had a lot of jobs.
Okay.
And I said, really? He said, yeah, because when we meet people and they've had too few jobs, they don't have enough ability to adapt things. They don't know enough. I said, well, explain that to me. He said, well, look, he said, if you come to work for us and you've had, you know, five different jobs at five different really interesting companies and, you know, it may occur like you seem like a journeyman, but the reality is that you've accumulated knowledge from a lot of different places. And it's good. When you come in here, you're going to bring a lot of different perspectives, which means that when we throw things at you, you're not going to be so stuck in the way that you think about stuff. Whereas if someone came here and they had like one job, they were really good at it, you know, it may take them a while to adapt to an environment that changes all the time. You know, it's a very unique place. And I was like, that's an interesting perspective. He was very adamant about this. He said, that's how they look for people. And he said, it's not just them. He said, the marketplace does. And I don't know if that's true, but, you know, it had me think differently about things.
I think there is a small, it is potentially truth in that. I think it depends. I mean, it depends on whether the person was successful at these companies, but then
if they got kicked out every 2 years, that's probably not a bad thing. Yeah.
That's usually what happens. I mean, think about it. If you're highly successful at a company, the likelihood is that you stay because you enjoy the success, you're earning great money, you love the product, you love what. So there's, you know, I think there's also a lot of truth in that. I think you've just got to assess the human and then work out, you know, do some digging from some of the people that you jointly connected with and find out if they're an asshole. That's the first thing. Yeah, but a good human. Huge. And then are they capable, you know, were they successful at the previous company or not? What I do find, I mean, that statement, I've met folks who have had lots of roles and I typically used to rule them out if they'd had too many too quickly. But I did have a person that we're hiring here who had this sort of lots and lots of role changes. What had happened, it was like he went to a startup, the startup failed, he got another job with another startup, was excited about that. They made everyone redundant. Then he got another company and then that company got acquired. He had this funny run where it actually was an actual story for each one. But that to an extent makes sense. But again, you got to check, check.
Yeah, you know, I think if I were to kind of like maybe even just get more succinct here, I think a lot of it's luck. I hate to say that.
Yeah, agreed.
But there, it really is, you know. I mean, it's like a marriage. You know, I have friends of mine who have really great marriages, and they say to me, I don't know, it's just, you know, I got lucky. You know, I mean, it was great, and it went well, but, you know, how could I have known that this was going to be like this? You know, you have a little bit of information to work on when you first get involved with each other. And it just worked out. And then other people who are just – so, you know, I know that there's not a lot of skill in that, but I do think a lot of it is there's energy and chemistry that – right place, right time, right person, right situation. And it's hard to sort of science your way through it, but you do have to apply some obvious principles and look for certain qualities and characteristics because that's going to get you closer to having your luck will improve. But I think there's a bit of a degree of it, of that.
Well, the other piece to it is some companies are hyper successful. There are examples right now, probably the most notable right now beyond ChatGPT is like Wiz. I mean, Wiz was the first line of code for Wiz was written in April 2020. I'm pretty sure they crossed 2 to 3 years later, $100 million in ARR, fastest company to $100 million in ARR. And then I think a year after that, they hit $200 million in ARR. I mean, this company was growing so fast And then you say, well, if you were one of the first few sellers in that place, your equity stake that you got as a little equity just to be the first frontline seller, you're now worth tens of millions of dollars from an equity stake because they're now worth $12 billion. And the speed of growth of that company is just astronomical. 99.999% of startups still haven't even hit a $1 billion valuation after 10 to 12 years, and this thing's there in 3 years. So there's an element of luck to your point around landing at the right company at the right time. And we all look at the people. You're always looking at the story. You always hear the stories of the one or two that lands in one of those, and you think that's repeatable. It's very difficult to repeat. That's very hard to predict what that will be. Who could have predicted ChatGPT was going to explode and happen to be in that company at that time? And the same goes for anything else. Who would have predicted Google and Facebook and everything else along the way?
So anyway, I want to thank you for being here. This is really great, really fun conversation, and very insightful. And I know that it's also, you know, getting close to you. Probably want to get some sleep. Of course. But thanks for being here, Michael. And we appreciate your wisdom and insights. And we hope to speak to you soon.
Pleasure. Thanks, Warren. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the CRO Insights podcast. Please subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode.